Dr. Kuntz, if greed is idolatry, as some translations of the Bible will say in Colossians 3, 5, and, you know, in the context of the seven deadly concept we were talking about last time, what's pride? Or is that just a false distinction?
No, it's not a false distinction, because you can look at the seven deadly sins and generally distinguish them not so much by their intensity, because they might be very intense, any one of them, for any one person, but by their object. Greed wants more material wealth. Lust wants someone it shouldn't. Those are different objects. The intensity might be the same. The problem might be the same. In fact, the fallout in your life, because you follow those vices to their natural conclusions, might be the same. But the object is different, and that's why the vices are distinguished from each other. Pride has usually been taken as an overarching problem, and maybe even the source of all problems, such that people have said that the original sin was pride. And that might sound a little odd to our Lutheran listeners, because I think we actually get it closer, much closer to right, if you need to define these things exactly. When we talk about what happens in Genesis chapter 3 as doubting the word of God.
Yeah.
I think we're much closer to the mark than to say that there's pride. The way that that's often explained in terms of Genesis 3 and other places is that the fall is a failed attempt to become gods, right? That's the promise attached to Satan's preaching, is that if you do this, what I say you should do, you will become like gods, knowing good and evil, defining good and evil. And I guess if you want to do that, you could say that. The problem is, at that point, that has little to no relationship to either of the senses of pride that we use it in life. So if you say that somebody is prideful, or you say that you're proud of how your daughter shot a three-pointer at the end of her, you know, middle school basketball game on Saturday, neither of those has a lot to do with your trying to transform into someone you're not. So I think it's safer to say, before we say anything else about pride, that the original sin, or the fount of all other sins, is distrust in God and in his word. Just basic first commandment stuff. Maybe pride has something to do with that, but sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes people distrust God and his word because they want to pursue their gluttony. Right? And they're not even particularly proud of that in any way. They just want to do it.
That's one of the things I find so useful about the seven deadlies as a framework, is what you just did there, you know, and how it enables you to see that pride is not everything. In fact, a lot of times it's working against the other seven spirits as they work with you. Now, I mentioned Colossians 3, 5, which is one of these lists of the works of the flesh that you mentioned last time as being perhaps, I don't know, a more biblical way of talking about the same idea as the seven deadlies. Not that the seven deadlies has no Christian background, right? But it's not directly pulled from a passage, it would seem.
Yeah, sure.
So Colossians 3, 5, or others, do you have a favorite list? I know that many constitutions reference Galatians has a list.
Colossians 3, 5 is one of the more helpful ones because of what comes right after it. So 3:5 reads, "Therefore put to death your members which are on the earth, fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry. Verse 6, because of these things, the wrath of God is coming upon the sons of disobedience, in which you yourselves once walked when you lived in them." Verse 7, maybe people who don't admit the reality of regeneration are most affected by that verse there, which says that this was your former way of life. You are not walking in these things anymore. You have to put them to death because God's wrath impends over those who pursue this, who are marked out in this specific case as the sons of disobedience. So disobedience is their origin. Again, I think the idea that the fount of sin is distrust in God and in his word. And then you could put the seven deadly sins under that or whatever other list you wanted to make. The list in verse 5 is actually a little bit less comprehensive than, say, let's say Romans, I want to say it's 1 off the top of my head. Let me find that. Because, yeah. Sure. Yeah.
Do you have... find that one. I mean, I want to get that. I'm thinking of the Galatians 5:19-21 as well, only because, again, it does have context,
yeah, that's fine,
to Missouri Synod polity usually, or at least it used to. A lot of constitutions have changed over the time.
But... yeah, our constitution does not. I'm rewriting our constitution, and we don't have any such list, but I can throw it in there. The reason I like Romans 1, and this is the very end of the chapter, is just because of how comprehensive it is. Because the problem is when someone, if someone reads Colossians 3:5 and says, well, the first three of those sound like they probably have some, I don't know Greek, but it sounds like they have something to do with sex. And, you know, that's not a problem for me now anymore. Or at the end, covetousness, and they look around and they have a very modest home and they're driving a used car they paid off 7 years ago. And so the problem there is that the purpose of a vice list of any length is to get you to use it. And this is where you get in our tradition, you get something called confession mirrors. Just to go back to last week. And you can find things like this. I think there's one in the Treasury of Daily Prayer. But what that does is it takes the Ten Commandments and turns it from prescription into questions. And I think that's fine. The seven deadly sins are doing the same thing by providing you not just with here's what you should do and leave undone, but also, since I know you go wrong, here's how you figure out what is going wrong with you. And the reason I like, you know, big fat vice lists like the one at the end of Romans 1 is because, for example, in verse 31, where it says that those who are disobedient to God and have a debased mind are undiscerning or without understanding. And I don't think that means that they're bad at calculus. I think that that is obviously relative to God's word, right? But it, so much more is covered by such a list so that a person can find his vices there or his temptations and then begin to go to war against them. I think a lot of people, when they're dealing with their own vices, or the reason that Colossians 3:7 about how you these things have... you're putting them away because you don't walk in them anymore. That is, you don't live your life with your behavior and thoughts governed by such things. The reason that might sound strange to anybody, I think, is because we are being generally far too general and superficial about sin. That if all sin has a single fount, when you get down to it, sin actually only ever manifests in particular ways. So because I'm not, even though my name's Adam, I can't go to a situation where I'm with, you know, the mother of all the living and reenact that. All I have are the ways sin manifests itself in many ways, I think. And I think the more that you know about your own family and your own family history and where they came from and what people were like, it's very easy to see how your sin manifests specifically, right? And I like the German term inherited sin for that reason.
Amen.
Right? But also that you attend to your particular vices, because some of them, and this is where I think we just kind of left this whole realm to psychology. We said, you know, hey, you know, you are angry all the time. You are sad about everything. You deal with conflict by trying to avoid it incessantly, whatever your problem is, right? And we kind of left that up to therapy or what's now more commonly called mental health counseling, partly because it's so much more widespread.
Pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, pharmaceuticals. And instead, we could have said, I mean, I don't have to go up there and give some kind of speech from the pulpit about biochemistry as if I know what I'm talking about. But on the basis of the Bible, I can say, here's a vice list. Based on how God made you, you're not prone to all of this all at the same time. Right? So there is also a theory of personality here, which obviously has a lot more to do with to what are you particularly prone because of your time of life, your station in life, whether you feel secure in what God has given you or not, what your forefathers did by and large, or they didn't do. So all of that, I think, is very helpful to people, but we usually don't do it. We kind of leave the private realm or the soul realm up to whatever other experts want to step in, right? Mm. And one of the most innocuous, but the reason it became so popular among Lutherans, Catholics, lots of people who shouldn't have cared in the 90s was because Focus on the Family talked about stuff that otherwise the church wasn't talking about, right? And that was just kind of raising kids mostly, right? From a guy, James Dobson, who had a background in psychology. And that's not an accident. So I think that you have in scripture these lists. And the reason I like the big ones is because it gives everybody food for thought. And I prefer this seven deadly sins thing to the confession mirror, because I think the thing that I found with confession mirrors is that they're always shaped by the writer.
Yeah.
So if the writer of the confession, instead of giving you a list of sins and then you think, the confession mirror, the writer is like, well, you know, I mean, obviously this is a caricature for clarity purposes, but it's like, did you pay complete attention throughout the service? Or at one point, were you really distracted by the fact that your bulletin fell out of your hymnal? You know, like, it's just kind of like, it's like morbid. And that's not even particularly helpful either, because there are always these specific instances of, I didn't pay attention for the last 5 minutes. The pastor is legitimately boring. He's monotonous in the way that he talks. You know, it's like, is that my fault or is that his fault? You know, I guess it's my fault in some way, but in another way, it's his fault. He needs to work on that too.
Talking about like a preaching reformation is something we probably could do at some point. But where I'm getting a lot out of this here is,
yeah,
again, that there's a particular genius at work in the development of the seven deadly sins as Christian tradition. The men who were praying when they, you know, developed this list, wherever this list came from, however it developed,
yeah,
they were pursuing something that's worth pursuing. And in that way, it's a nice lens to then go back to these lists of works of darkness in the scripture, Romans 1, Galatians 5, right. Colossians 3, there's lots of them. And what I've liked to do is, again, then set the seven deadlies against these lists and try to see, okay, now, where is this showing up? What is unrepresented? You know, what else is in this list? You know, or can I fit it all into this seven? Because it isn't really, you know, one thing. It's the spirit of, as you said, disobedience, lack of hearing, unbelief, unbelief. How else do you describe it? High-handed unbelief. Which again can be pride, but pride is one of these seven ways to talk about it. I like another one that we have to recapture on some level is obedience itself.
Yeah.
Obedience as a word. The law gospel dynamic for a good part of my life sort of made that not allowed as a word out of concern that I might somehow, you know, be legalistic by asking for obedience. And that was all with knowing that the word at its root means to hear. And to listen, it really is like hupakuo in the Greek New Testament, largely a auditory or an oral hearing and response word. And so to obey the gospel, of course, is simply to believe, right? To receive what is given. Whereas to obey, say, the apostle, as he says, put to death these things in your body. Well, that's not legalistic. That's not misdiagnosing law and gospel. That's Christian behavior and regenerate Holy Spirit in life. And so for me, this discussion is largely continuing that pursuit and just wanting to be the kind of 21st century Christian man who pursues such things and doesn't let whatever other winds are being blown about the screen tell me everything. Although that is kind of where I want to go next, unless you want to say one more thing on.
Yeah, I mean, one more thing about the seven deadly sins is that their probable origin in the monastic movement in the third and fourth centuries, both Eastern and Western, means that they are focused more narrowly than the scriptures do on particularly inner vices. And they then have to explain outwardly manifesting vices. So let's say that your inner vice is wrath and your outwardly manifesting vice is that you blow up every so often. Chances are, however, that you don't blow up at all the same people, or that you might blow up at people in the private part of your life, but not the public part of your life, or that you don't even blow up at that the same people within the private realm. You only blow up at your spouse, or you only blow up at your kids or whatever. So the question to ask yourself is why? And the seven deadly sins don't have much of that relational aspect of sin to them, just because their origin is not even in, you know, communal, like, let's say, Benedictine monasticism, where if you read the Rule of Saint Benedict, it's going to have, you know, information like this and lists of, you know, what to leave undone and what to pursue. But it also has a lot of information about how you relate to the other people in the monastery. The seven deadly sins predate that. So they predate widely organized communal life among monastics. And so if you are alone all of the time, a lot of what the scriptures have to say about relationship and how you know, haters of parents are among the vices, right? That's going to be left aside. So I think one thing that the scriptural vice list, particularly in the New Testament, have that the seven deadlies do not is that they also cover all those relational aspects where, you know, you are a faithless person, not meaning that you don't believe in God, but that no one can rely on you. Right. And so that's to me, that's the biggest shortcoming of the seven deadly sins.
Sure. I think that's a really good criticism and a limitation, as I can think any list, any framework by itself is going to be limited. That's why scripture gives us so much and so many. I really like, though, that, you know, that bug is kind of a feature if you see it that way, that the inner diagnostic for which the seven deadlies give you a frame to assess your own heart at the moment, at the day, and that with the duties, the virtues that come concurrently, you know, humility, kindness, generosity, patience, that, again, it isn't going to hurt you if you're living in the Gnostic crazy world we're in right now to start using this framework to try to kind of splice a few of your relationships and find out if that's not what's going wrong, like on your part, right?
Right.
Like maybe you are slothful. Maybe that's why you stare at the screen too much. Right? Maybe that's actually a thing, right? And so I find the list to be, again, helpful at a point. And maybe that point is precisely what you mentioned earlier, where the isolation of the queen of the sciences from all other sciences, the giving over of the soul in psychology to secular man and abandoning the knowledge of God in theology, I think that has a lot to do with much of what we see going on in people's home life and problems.
Yeah.
So whatever 100%. Frame from the Bible you can get, right, to put back into life is where we want to go. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, we talk in the Lutheran Church, at least, about this, usually using the German word Seelsorge, soul care. But that always has really significant integration with psychology when we talk about it, as the word has been revived in use. And it doesn't really have the primacy in handling individual souls that it did in former times, where psychological insights, such as they are when you look in the past, are going to be subordinated to spiritual diagnosis. And that means that in practice, the person who has more social prestige and can also give you pills is going to take preeminence and probably has soul direction, you know, honestly, S-O-L-E, over your soul, because that's much easier to default to. And soul care, S-O-U-L, over you by any kind of other Christian, let alone a Christian pastor, is going to be sort of few and far between, because you yourself and maybe the pastor too are not really thinking of most of the things in your life as having to do with your soul. That's one segment, in the same way that Sunday is this one little exception to the rest of life, and you know, only on Sundays does male headship apply, and that's why we don't have girl pastors, but nothing else applies. In the same way, on Sundays, we can talk about guilt and we can provide a religious solution for it. But all of the other weirdness that goes on inside of you, Monday through Saturday, and, you know, let's, you know, Sunday from lunchtime onward, all of that is handled by the person who can give you pills.
Yeah, Gnostic Jesus is not good enough. What are you actually doing with your body? It'll tell you what you're worshiping if you pay attention, take a few notes. So I was paying attention this week, and
yeah,
it looks like some sort of, I don't know anymore. It's so weird, the British. So they just did this thing where they changed the guard, and it's like really special this one day because there's like an extra white horse or something. And there's a black flag that's covered or something. And you can see it on Twitter. We'll have a link to it, you know, in the show notes. This came up and it was like the first thing on my feed. Okay. First thing on my feed. Listener, beware, right? And it says, this is so surprising. How did anybody know to do this? And the video footage looks like someone really knew how to do this, if you watch it. But all this said, it's a pretty unique glory moment of the British crown, possibly connected to the death of Jacob Rothschild. And that's really what I want to know is, you know, do you care that the guy died? I mean, of course we should care, but he poses before pictures of Lucifer like it's a cool thing. So what do we think of this as Christians? Or do Christians just put our heads in the sand like normal and say it means nothing that the richest guy in the world just died?
Of course, this is kind of quickly stuff from a couple years ago, but the foundation of Britain's modern prosperity, not from our colonial age, but especially from the 19th century and what has continued to be the case, and what undergirds what's now called the House of Windsor. It had a longer German name before.
That was an awesome name, by the way. It was so horribly German. It was great. Oh my goodness.
But I mean, the very arriviste of them too, you know, just completely changed their name. That has always been undergirded by not only the Rothschild family and its various operations in various European countries, but you could say by the modern system of finance, about which we have two different, but I just need to do a lot of research to answer them, listener questions about usury and the Federal Reserve, respectively, and their history. There's just a lot of detail there that I need time to figure out. So the connection between the Rothschild family, or a branch of the Rothschild family, and Britain's regime, you might say, is and should be obvious if you've done any digging, because Britain is the first modern country to have a central bank, the Bank of England, which also dates to the deposition of James II. In the very late 17th century.
Right after the like Catholic king printed an English Bible and he was Scottish, it all went British with some banking maneuvers. I might be a Jacobite. I don't know enough, but I might be.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a Jacobite. I'm a Protestant.
Well, amen. Got me there.
Well, those things are very, unless you're Scottish, those things are very definitely different. I am Scottish. Okay.
So,
I have ancestors on both sides of that war, just like a couple other wars. And the Scotsmen were Protestant too in that case. But in any case, what's happening there is that this is the way that this regime is sustained, is through modern banking, which is a combination of fractional reserve banking with state banking that enables something like the House of Windsor to endure, even though it does not have the kind of power monarchies would have had in Britain, let's say prior to 1688. But it solves the problem of the monarchy being perpetually underfunded and being reliant directly on the gentry, you might say, or the peerage, in the way that it was that helped get them into the English Civil War. So that's the basic issue going on here. And if you are very interested in this, and who Jacob Rothschild is, and who his family is, there's plenty of very weird information. And I want to explain what I mean by weird in a second, but there's very, very mainstream information that will tell you everything I just said and a lot more from the greatest court historian that our modern establishment in Western countries, you could say in the NATO countries or whatever, has, and that's Niall Ferguson. Niall Ferguson is, I want to say he's at Harvard. He might be at Stanford. He's at a Ford with a lot of money. And he now writes mostly about military history and let's say modern history, but he got his start just doing financial history. And he's got a giant 2-volume set that was published by Penguin. So not an academic press, a mainstream press. That's how much play he's getting, called The House of Rothschild. So that explains where they came from and how they got from the continent to Britain and all this kind of thing. What I mean by weird information about the Rothschilds is similar to when we talked about Bohemian Grove. Was that last week?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Here's what I mean by weird. The existence of, we said this 800 million times on the show, but the existence of conspiracy is just a facet of human life, especially human political existence. People are always getting together for various purposes in a more or less secret fashion for reasons you might find noble or ignoble. Okay, so a lot of things that would later be called, maybe inaccurately, they weren't that organized, but would later be called the Underground Railroad in order to help fugitive slaves get north or farther north, maybe even all the way to Canada, essentially existed by way of conspiracy because they had to, particularly in border states. Farther north, they could be a little more open. In an Ohio or a Pennsylvania, they couldn't be open. And so they existed essentially by way of conspiracy. Conspiracy is a way that humans function at times. The thing that is weird about a lot of information about the Rothschilds, and this relates to our inability to be clear, which is really an inability to be specific about what we're saying, is that it will attribute all kinds of evils to the Rothschilds, to Freemasonry, to which they are connected. Go read Niall Ferguson. But it will then stop and then say, okay, the world is run by X. It's run by pedophiles. It's run by the Freemasons. It's run by the Illuminati. It's run by the Jews. It's run by whoever. And the problem there is that it doesn't really recognize, if you think that any of those groups is doing some kind of evil collectively, then you have to figure out, well, what evil are they doing and why are they doing it? Because what really quickly happens when you don't like a group that is more powerful than you is that they become an explanation for evil that really is not only parallel to Satan, but I would say greater than Satan. So they attribute a power over life, over everything, to a specific international bankers, right? Non-ethnically specific group that, if you just look at the way that they talk about it, and this is why you can find Christians and non-Christians swimming in the same soup or morass or whatever you want to call whatever it is they're in together. The reason you can find them both there is because the Christian is not really discerning that the non-Christian, who doesn't believe in Satan or in attacking his own vices, he's in fact comfortable with them. That's what the Bible would teach you about the sons of disobedience. They're actually comfortable with what they're doing. Luther talks about that pretty clearly in the Large Catechism about the comfort that the sons of this age have with their sins. They can talk about whatever group they're going after, right? So on the absolute, you know, wildest wing of this, right, David Icke can say these people are all literally reptilian. They're humanoid reptiles. Okay.
I like it. I want to believe it.
But the Rothschilds stand in the same way. In the past, particularly on the European continent, and the Missouri Synod really partakes of this in the way that it talks about Freemasonry, is that they are nefarious deists and they're trying to overthrow everything. Which in some cases in Germany and France and Hungary, they were, right? And that, you know, and that was Freemasonry. So what you do is you've got this group. They are a group. The Rothschilds are a family with many branches of long standing and a lot of resources and power. And they're integrated into various powerful groups in various countries, the French, as well as the British aristocracy, as well as other places, the United States of America.
And I believe some connections to Davos, Switzerland, too, which is fun.
Yeah. And Switzerland is an interesting piece of this puzzle because Switzerland is kind of carved out. And if you guys are interested in that, I can look into that. There's definitely a period where Switzerland becomes something for the nations that it hadn't been. It had been explicitly basically just there to protect itself and to keep itself from descending into civil war. And then it becomes something for an international establishment that is growing over time. Because Carol Quigley locates everything in this nexus of, you know, WASP and Jewish bankers, essentially.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Kind of his nice Irish-American conspiracy theory.
Well, yet again, it is the Europeans thinking they're supposed to run the world, which really does frustrate me, even though, you know, Scottish, we try to get away from this kind of behavior and just can't get far enough away from it. I think if I might comment on the conspiracy talk, you're spot on the religious fervor and the need to like super identify all the problems with one person or one group that, in my experience, most conspiracy theorist junkies don't play so consistent.
No.
They will Mott and Bailey all the time in who's who and what's what, when, where, but it all is going to hang together somehow. And my comment is kind of like, I actually agree a little bit. Like, obviously, Satan's doing something. Obviously, there's some really bad people out there with a lot of money doing some really wicked stuff.
Yeah.
Obviously, they're going to get punished by God and you shouldn't live, you know, under their roof if you can help it, right? Maybe not buy and trade with everything they say buy and trade with. But at the end of the day, this is no different from any other time in history.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where the scales were becoming unbalanced by the wicked men who gained power. They joined house to house, right? It's all over the prophets to the level where you have Marxists today who think the prophets are Marxists because, in fact, you know, the proletariat has a complaint once in a while.
Yeah.
I really do.
Yeah. I go at it this way, if this is helpful to you, is that something to notice about the construction of conspiracy theories, that is, how does a given conspiracy work? Or there is a given conspiracy, I'm saying point one, and then point two, here's how it works, or point three, here's who's involved or whatever, right? Is that it can be and can remain an armchair activity.
Yes.
And so something you'll notice is that conspiracy theories are disparaged in mainstream sources for all kinds of reasons that are maybe too obvious to say. I mean, it's a combination of this is our competition, along with we think it's stupid, along with this works against our political and economic interests, all kinds of reasons, right?
Controlled opposition too.
But you will notice it is the person doesn't have to be, quote, controlled opposition even, because how do I ever prove that either, right? Are Jonathan Fisk and Adam Kuntz being paid by Peter Thiel to gatekeep in the, you know, largely in the Lutheran Church with a handful of generally Latin Mass Catholics and evangelicals? I mean, I can tell you no all day, but you know,
we are the worst cult
right.
ever.
You're either going to believe me or not believe me, right? Which is, you know, we're back to square one here. You don't need to posit that everything is controlled opposition, because you can notice that what people you don't like really get upset about is not what's happening on the internet. It is what is happening in real life. So currently, various political groups, and this is not a conspiracy theory, are flying assorted evangelical talkers into and around Colorado's Front Range, because the town of Woodland Park, Colorado, outside of Colorado Springs, which used to be the absolute epicenter of the evangelical world and isn't anymore, partly thanks to the U.S. military and how it's changed, but it's still where Focus on the Family is headquartered. Woodland Park is outside Colorado Springs and has been, quote, taken over by, quote, Christian nationalists, a term, as I've said, and I'm still going to maintain, largely without meaning, except that it's supposed to be scary. The reason they're willing to fly, you know, purportedly evangelical speakers in to denounce Christian nationalism, the reason they're having public fora about the dangers of Christian nationalism, is because a certain church has put forward multiple successful candidates for the school board. What people are really worried about is that you would actually change their lives in a way that they don't like, not that you would have a nasty opinion of them on the internet. They know ultimately that's a very passive activity. It would matter a lot more if you think the Rothschilds have too much control over the world, you know, David Icke or whoever, Alex Jones, if you somehow tried to either infiltrate by way of employment, or made it your sole goal to pull the United States out of the Bank of International Settlements. You've probably never heard of that. It has a lot to do with how many things work financially. That would be something, right? And they would get upset. Nobody cares that you are angry that they fly jets to Davos, Switzerland to talk about climate change. They don't care that you're angry about that. That doesn't matter.
This is ultimately then my point about being controlled opposition, so long as you are watching the show. Like, if you're watching the show, they're letting you see you are doing what they want. And you're not out there, you know, learning what Dr. Kuntz just said about international monetary policy and the American debt cycle and all the ways that Ron Paul's been trying to fix that for a while. Out at the
wow,
Fed.
That's taking me back. Okay.
Out at the Fed. Hey, Rand Paul just said it today. Out at the Fed. But I want to talk instead. I had a nice link to this before. What was it? Conspiracy theories. You think there's a conspiracy going on at Google with Gemini, like, refusing to paint pictures of white people? Does it matter? Everyone's all mad. I mean, we knew Google was bad to begin with. It's not the only AI out there, but this is like a low-hanging fruit for you, right? Like, you want to hit the AI. Like, hit what Google's doing with Gemini. They're rewriting history. That's telling lies directly. All manner of stuff going on.
Yeah. Yeah, that is... And you've got this other link about this guy, Aaron Bushnell, who is very upset about the freedom of Palestine.
Right. So this is the Air Force member that set himself on fire.
Yeah, he's dead.
And everyone saw that briefly if you were on Twitter. And then we find out later he is, in fact, as far left as you can get. Yeah. And so there's a link to the what the event that was held for him, where you can see quite the intersectional group showing up and in fact calling for violent action against the US and things like that. So
yeah, okay. And the reason I want to link those is because the development of AI, even apart from the, let's say, moral regime that we have, and the reason to talk about this moral regime is because it is an injustice on which we are currently founded, and it has been backed off in certain sectors. So if you go to a public university in a red state, these things are changing very rapidly, even in sort of a mushy GOP dominated state like Utah, let alone in a Florida or a Tennessee or a Texas. But what you're dealing with is that you have a moral regime premised on the categorical evil of various classes, most of whom are intersectionally related, whites related to males, related to Christians, related to, and you might fall into one of those categories or you might not, but the basis there is that, to my mind, this is the secular left's version of the secular right's exaltation of whatever group they dislike so much into the equivalent of Satan. So if Satan is not the Rothschilds or the Freemasons or whatever, Satan is instead white Christian heterosexual males or those who ally themselves with them in any way for any purpose. So you can, those people are demonized, they become demons, and then the demons have to be exorcised from institutions and whatever else. The reason to say that is not just because it's happening, it's also because it is the way that they are trying to shape the way reality is explained to you. That's why fights over education matter so much, because that is where you learn this stuff. Right. It's not just movies, but capturing your attention is getting increasingly difficult, because how do I have enough time to give you this information on TikTok? Whereas if I had a relatively limited supply of TV combined with movies, it's much easier to get this information to you about what you're supposed to think about history. If I don't have that, it's really important that if I do have you in school, at least, not that your attention is really captive, because I probably gave you an iPad and you're probably staring at that or like playing games on that or doing whatever you're doing on that. But for those who are listening, I can then, you know, I can talk in ways that will convince you that the moral regime I just described is true. And that's also why you see, you know, high school teachers have kind of gone the way of university professors. Like, they're getting increasingly reliably left wing in public schools. Why is this? It's not a mystery. They did this in universities 50, 60 years ago. That's why Google's AI project is shaping itself the way it is. Because I need to convince you, and I mean, unfortunately, we were taught to identify this with the Soviets. So we just thought, we don't do this, we would never do this, etc. You know, and that's very naive. Everybody uses history for his own purposes, always has. But that the level of dishonesty would be there, that, you know, AI will not produce a picture of whatever American revolutionary soldiers without putting in the full spectrum of human beings you could possibly find in Los Angeles as we record this today. That's just so you don't think that anything was not the way that they say it is. That's the purpose. And that is what motivates this 25-year-old guy, Aaron Bushnell. Bushnell is that's an old New England name. He's from Massachusetts, I think. Why does he care about Palestine so much? I mean, even to the extent of, you know, not just being angry about it, but setting himself on fire. And then this is the kind of person that is in our military. You know, that has to do, I mean, I think
what
it's
kind of NSAIDs was he taking, right? Is he on antidepressant medication? You know, that I really mean
almost guaranteed. almost yeah. guaranteed, just yeah. as a statistical probability. But I think that the thing to wonder about here is, why doesn't this guy care more about what's going on with, say, the U.S. military? Like, why has he not set himself on fire for whatever? Homeless veterans, who knows, right? Or why didn't this happen during the Iraq War? Why didn't somebody set himself on fire during the Iraq War? Because we have all of these nice boys with their legs getting blown off. For what purpose? You know, that didn't happen, right? So he's allowed to take, and this is, I mean, along seven deadly sins lines, what sins do is that they pull on things that are there anyway, right? They pervert good things of God. And one of the good things of God is people actually, I was going to use a more colorful phrase, it's a family show, actually caring, just doesn't have the same ring, but it's okay, mm-hmm. family show, actually caring about things, like not being so depressed and inwardly focused that they don't care about things and they wouldn't sacrifice themselves for their family, their country, whatever, right? But it's like he can't get to the point of sacrificing himself for his country. He wasn't, you know, I think he was in the Air Force, but I don't think he was like a JTAC or a paratrooper or anything like that, any kind of Air Force Special Forces where he would actually be deployed in a combat. He's not an aviator. I don't know what he did, but you know, he's not sacrificing himself for his country in any respect that you could say that. He is using a Vietnam era tactic. That's the way it looks in America anyway. I mean, I know people set themselves on fire in lots of places for lots of reasons over time, but for us, this is a Vietnam era tactic.
It's a pretty rare Western Civ thing to do yourself. Like it's, people used to do it to yes, other people, right?
Yes.
It has very clear symbolic reality connected to it.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, the notion of enduring fire in Western civilization has to do with going through it, not with turning into it, right? Yeah. So self-immolation is something that, I mean, we got it largely from Buddhists in Vietnam who would do this as an act of protest. But that was also connected to the way that Buddhists look at the body and that the body can be destroyed and it doesn't matter, and that a monastic defines himself by being beyond suffering. For us, I mean, one of your paradigmatic fire stories in Western civilization is Mucius Scaevola, who puts his hand into the fire to prove that Romans will endure any pain for the sake of their country. But the point is that he holds it there long enough to be impressive. It's not that he burns himself up. It's somebody else's
power over the, it's somebody power over the pain.
Yes, he has power over the pain.
It's what you get from this soldier is the despair. I mean, this isn't the Buddhist monk in some great sign of his confidence in where he's going, although we would disagree with what that's going to be. But like, this is not that. This is a society gasping for its own destruction.
I think the Buddhist monk, because remember this happens in South Vietnam, which most people don't remember, is not only ultimately governed by the Americans, it's governed by the percentage of Vietnamese who are practicing Roman Catholics. I actually think there was a lot of despair in the Buddhist monk doing that, that he would rather exit altogether than have to endure this. Okay. Because it is suicide. And what is fundamentally the issue with suicide? Disobedience to God and his word. Yes. Distrust. Yes. But it's also taking into your own hands control over something for whatever significance you want to give it. South Vietnam, Palestine, whatever, taking into your own hands something that belongs to God to determine. Okay. So Bushnell is willing to do this. This is what's remarkable to me. I think you're right. I think it is a despairing way to protest. It's the opposite of someone trying to shoot up a public place, even though those people often ultimately commit suicide. But political shooters often don't commit suicide because they're not in despair about what they're doing. This guy's in despair. He's in despair about what exactly? I mean, this is like an outsourced thing. In the video, it's not his. It's not a problem in Washington, D.C. It's not a problem in Massachusetts. I mean, he's not even from Michigan, where maybe you would actually have known many Palestinians. And maybe there's details about his life that will come out that we don't know. But what is remarkable to me is that his passion to care about some group of people has nothing to do with any group of people he actually belongs to.
Or is near, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's all a fabricated story on the other side of the planet. And it's not that it isn't true that there aren't people on all sides of this planet. But I think your point is that if we have no capacity to live beside with for those who we live beside with and for,
yeah,
and instead a capacity to rage, riot, and destroy for the sake of those we've never seen and do not know, well, then again, what do we have that's worth saving as a civilization? And I think on some level, you know, we're here saying, yeah, nothing. If you aren't coming back to the foundation and the root, we're closing in on the end of time here. And I got one more piece of the news I do want to put out there. It's just on this ongoing COVID thing, reality. Senator Ron Johnson continues to do very public work in which he brings together those scientists and independent thinkers who believe that there was some great evil that was done to the population by these large pharmaceutical companies. And I you know, it's old news in a sense. The current statement is that this is bioweapons industry in the U.S., that there's more of this going on, that there's other facilities that we should be aware of as a populace. I want to just bring this back to that kind of that question when we started this show, like, why are we even allowed to talk about these things? Should Lutheran pastors care? And at the point again now where, let me just put it in perspective, we have to figure out, does the government that we pay taxes to and we do what they say, generally speaking, in fact fund illegal bioweapons work on our shores against our knowledge, against our laws? And have they in fact turned that on us as a population? And this is where my brother pastors out there who are like, well, you know, we just leave it up to God. Well, you know, we're here to preach the gospel. I just don't understand where the disconnect is between the people who you care about and the thieves and liars who are hurting them and the gospel we claim to preach. Now go be well, be fed. I there's a limit to all of that. There's so much on the table, like we just talked about. What's on the screen? What can you fight? Fight what's in front of you. But again, when the U.S. Senate has a sitting senator who's willing to talk about these things and it's still verboten as a conversational topic in our church body, I got a real concern with that.
Yeah, and I don't know myself, and this is also just my incapacity to grasp all the social subtleties of stuff. Is what is forbidden versus what is just awkward. And sometimes they're the same thing. This is definitely awkward. It might be forbidden. I don't really know, because it's hard for me to know or care about people's opinions who refuse to actually state them. Right? Like, well, I'm really angry on the inside about what you just said. Okay, well then, like, go ahead and say it. If I can, I want to talk therefore maybe a little bit more about the claim in the clip that should be in the show notes,
yeah,
by this guy Harvey Risch about a bioweapons industry, because the issue there is that we are not officially doing a lot of the things that we may unofficially be doing. And usually that claim is made about things that are, I think, a little more openly dark or black or obscure, in the sense of a black budget given to the National Security Agency. So, you know, here's what they're actually, but very, very unofficially and illegally doing. And here's what officially is being said and, you know, and is being funded. so it's not hard for me to think that similar things are happening in biotech or are happening very broadly in what are called the life sciences. What is very awkward about all of that is that it's kind of one thing to steal my data, but it's another thing to alter my body, even in ways that if they don't have to do with genetic expression directly, as mRNA vaccines do, they ultimately, via epigenetic causes, so causes sitting on top of my genome specifically, will alter the genetic expression of future generations. And that's recognized in something that, at least currently, I think this is kind of a blue state cause. I don't think it's bad at all, but it has only got political traction in blue states, and that is the banning of forever chemicals. So, you know, look, like, make fun of California all you want for all kinds of reasons. I don't think it's bad that California is the only thing that requires various companies to tell you, like, the lining on your coffee cup is poisoning you.
Like, yeah, right. Right.
Like, go for it, California.
I remember the first time I looked that up, I bought a box and the box said, you know, in California, you know,
right,
this is
in
blah,
California.
Blah.
Only.
And then when I looked it up, is it Prop 6? I forget what it was. And I looked up, holy moly, that's a good law.
Right? right. And so, unfortunately, that's just a blue state cause right now. But it's, you know, it's like, look, like, This way of using human beings like they are some sort of cattle population, and we're going to poke them with this and then they'll react in this way and they'll be that much, you know, fatter next year, whatever it is that is being aimed at or monetized or whatever. You know, the idea that somehow that's happening in AI or that's happening in, you know, whatever other specifically, let's say, tech sector, hardware, software sector, but somehow is not happening in the life sciences. That, I mean, that's crazy. Like, of course it's happening in the life sciences. So the idea that this affects pharmaceuticals, this affects agricultural research, that all kind of intrinsically makes sense to me, right? It's not like only, especially through our two giant wars of last century and then the stand down that never came after the second one. It's not that only information technology was affected, right? Everything was affected. Everything gets money from that nexus of, you know, government cash, which is enabled by reserve banking, which then flows into all of life. And of course affects the decisions and the research and the priorities, especially of funding in all the sciences, not just in computer science.
Well, and in all the institutions which rely on it, which unfortunately means all of our congregations at this point. And we had someone get mad at us once because we wouldn't just say, get off the dollar, because you kind of can't. That's the problem. It's a trap. We're trapped, you see. And yet that is the conversation that needs to be had in terms of if and when the churches are going to wake up from their stupor, it will be in realizing how much they have served the dollar in their thinking and served the profiteering mindset of the age we are in. And that doesn't mean we can't hold the ground we have and come back to a more kind of rigorous stand against worldliness as a people, even while we watch the world perhaps burn itself down around us. But it does mean we have to cease being churches founded on the financial capacities of America to keep going. And I really do think that is the box most of us are still living in our heads. Yeah. And, you know, it's as simple as Jesus owns the money. Jesus owns the cattle on 1,000 hills. And it's as difficult as maybe attendance numbers and budgetary numbers don't matter so much right now as, you know, what do the people believe? Like, that matters a lot right now. It always matters, but it matters a lot right now. You know, is this group just here for this building, or is this group here because they are born again? And that kind of talk, I think, in the Missouri Synod is the antidote to our refusal to face all of the things which our country has been doing to us, both directly and indirectly, at least since we went into English. and didn't even really think much about that as we did that, I would say. So not exactly an upper moment. Do you want to bring us home with something more positive?
I think what is more positive is that you will realize in time, if you haven't been forced to, this is the way providence works, is that God will often force you to improve realizations and performance as he needs to use you as his instrument. He'll put you into the horrible situation that's going to be great for you later on, is that you are dealing with a situation where the reason the future is scary is because your dependence on the past is being tested. And that's why I have railed against nostalgia, but it's also why I think it's exciting, because we're looking at a situation in which we will have to become new kinds of servants. We can't be the kinds of servants in the ways that we've been in the past. And that'll be fun. You know, I think that'll be fun. But if you're not willing to sail to unknown lands, then, you know, you probably just need to admit you're going to be staying home.
Scared to be alive, right? Let's do it the other way. Life is meant for times like these. You're listening to A Brief History of Power. You know where to find us, or you would not be here.
What do you think of when you hear the word college? Expensive? Liberal? Woke? Imagine a college that is affordable, a college that is unapologetically conservative and Lutheran, a college that won't take a dime of federal funding, a college that teaches the best of our Western heritage, a college where students grow in the Christian faith instead of leaving it behind. This is Luther Classical College, a college by Lutherans and for Lutherans. Visit our website, lutherclassical.org, subscribe, become a patron, and join the thousands who are making Luther Classical College a reality.
North Idaho is home to beautiful mountains and scenic lakes, small town tranquility, civil freedom, and the faithful Lutheran parish of Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church, located in Hayden, Idaho, near Coeur d'Alene. Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church is a proud sponsor of A Brief History of Power. If you like what you hear on Brief History, then you will love Blessed Sacrament, where the Lord's Word is faithfully preached and Christ's body and blood are administered at every divine service. Whether you are visiting Idaho or considering moving to Idaho, wouldn't it be nice? Please join the saints of Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church for the Mass and Augsburg Academy Bible Study. Directions, service times, and much more information about this confessional liturgical parish may be found at blessedsacramentlutheranchurch.com. Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church, Historic Christian Orthodoxy, the Evangelical Lutheran Faith in the beautiful Inland Northwest. We'll be right back.